Welcome to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Strokes, Building Up a Nerve, a podcast for neuroscience trainees that takes you through the components of a grant application with successful awardees. We know that applying for NIH funding can be daunting, but we are here to help. It's our job.
Hello, I'm Marguerite Matthews, a scientific program manager at NINDS.
And I'm Lauren Ulrich, a program director at NINDS, and we're your hosts today.
In today's episode, we'll focus on the mentor and sponsor statement section. We have a slightly different format today as we have invited mentor and mentee pairs to talk about their process. We will discuss how they ensured that the training plan reflected the individual needs of the trainee and that the mentor was able to provide the appropriate support and expertise to achieve these training goals.
And as always, our disclaimer still applies. Everything we talk about may only be relevant for NINDS. So if you're applying to a different NIH institute or center, it's always best to check with them about their policies.
And for our guests today, we have Alexis Mobley and her mentor, Yarek Aronowski, Monique Mendez and her mentor, Anya Majeska, and Margaret Ho and her mentor, Mark Wu. So let's get started with introductions. Alexis, you're up.
Awesome. So my current institution is the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, UT Health Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences. What I focus on in the lab is looking at the communication between ILC2s and microglia in the aged brain between males and females, and trying to understand what ways that ILC2s either maintain or downregulate their cytokine signaling to microglia and how microglia respond using mouse models. So far, I've gotten the diversity supplement. I'm working with Dr. Aronowski, and I've also been awarded an F31 that'll start in January. Oh, and my career stage, I'm a fifth year PhD student in neuroinflammation at the graduate school. One of my hobbies and passions outside of work is just being in the community in different facets. So I'm currently singing with a choir, International Voices Houston, which right now we're doing a bunch of virtual programming, but I'm also one of the co-founders of Black and Amino. So I've been using that stage and platform to help advocate and celebrate and support Black voices in immunology.
That's so awesome. Black and Amino has been such a delight to just watch. I don't know anything about immunology, but I very much enjoy seeing you all just be so wonderful and share your science, along with many of the other Black in STEM groups that are popping up. It's awesome. So congratulations for being a part of that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we have a lot of fun, and we have a lot of fun with the other Black in groups as well. So it's nice getting to kind of have a party. I call it an extended family reunion for all of us, just to be able to celebrate each other.
Hi, it's Yarek Aronowski. I am a professor and vice chair of neurology at University of Texas Health Science Center, McGovern Medical School. I am here for past 35 years, so it is quite a while. I have a long experience of interacting with diverse group of students, from graduate students to fellows over the years. And I have a super pleasure to have interacting with Alexis, probably one of the smartest students we had here. She is fantastic. And when it comes to my past, I mean, I'm mainly interested in neurological cerebrovascular diseases, including ischemic stroke and intracerebral hemorrhage, and trying to understand how actually those diseases exist in the background of age as well as the other comorbids. We are trying to develop translational approaches to actually come up with an idea how to treat those diseases. When it comes to my hobby, probably a sport, jogging, is something that I can safely exercise these days when the COVID is around. Being sometimes lonely in the park makes you feel fairly good. Otherwise, I love classical music and a lot of other intellectual challenges.
We definitely have a lot of runners and a lot of musically inclined people on this podcast. So I'm wondering if they're particularly popular hobbies among scientists for some reason.
Hi, everyone. My name is Monique Mendez. I am currently a postdoc in Dr. Mark Schnitzer's lab at Stanford University. I applied and received the F99K00 grant, and I am a member of the second cohort. I'm actually smiling from ear to ear right now because you don't usually run into like other neuroimmunologists that study microglia, and hearing like Alexis talk about microglia, I was like, yay, go microglia. In Dr. Anya Majeska's lab at the University of Rochester, where I did my F99 work, I focused on understanding and learning about microglia ontogeny, how microglia are born and how they mature in the adult mouse brain. And we used advanced imaging techniques such as in vivo two-photon microscopy to really track these microglia and understand how they are interacting with other cells, how they are maturing in the adult brain. And my work in Dr. Mark Schnitzer's lab at Stanford is now focused on another type of glial cells known as astrocytes and how they participate in hippocampal network function and behavior. And in terms of a hobby, kind of going with the theme as well, I love classical music. I play violin. I love music. And most recently, I've picked up a little bit of tennis since the weather is really beautiful here in California. So yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
I play string bass, so I feel like we're going to need to get together to have a little string quartet. We got to find a few other players.
Yes, we have to.
Anya Majeska, I'm a professor at the University of Rochester in the Department of Neuroscience. I also direct our neuroscience graduate program. And my lab is really interested in how the brain changes with experience, so mechanisms of plasticity, both in health and disease. And largely focused on how different cell types interact lately, particularly how microglia and neurons interact. And as for a hobby, I have three boys between the ages of 5 and 15, and they are my hobby. There's pretty much nothing else in my life except driving them to all their various activities and having fun with them. So,
seems like especially in the pandemic, you probably have your hands full.
Hi, everyone. My name is Margaret Ho. I'm currently a postdoc fellow at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland, in the School of Medicine, and I work with Dr. Mark Wu. The grant that I applied for successfully is the K99 under the Brain Initiative, and my research aims to study the functional and genetic heterogeneity of astrocytes in the fly brain and their role in sleep behavior. So I'm really excited that actually so many of us are studying glia. It's a great cohort. So astrocytes are, you know, representing a large portion of cells in the brain, but they're not as studied as well as neurons. People have shown that they're important for formation and modulation of neuronal circuits, and there's lots of evidence that they play roles in signaling and behavior in the brain. And the goal of my research is to systematically investigate genes related to astrocyte heterogeneity and diversity, and to study the local astrocyte neuron interactions regulating sleep and arousal using imaging and behavior. And my plan is also to use these experiments to generate genetic tools that allow me to study specific astrocyte populations. So this was my first application ever for an NIH grant, and I've helped former PIs write NIH grants before, but this is my first time as an applicant. But I have applied for other awards like the NSF GFRP. And one of my favorite things to do outside of work is just go outside and go running on trails and be in nature. I love that.
Wow, we've got the neuroimmuno crew and the running crew.
I know, it wasn't even on purpose, I swear. All right, Mark, last but not least.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mark Wu. I am a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins. So, you know, my lab is interested in studying the molecular and circuit basis underlying sleep. We use fruit flies and mice to study these questions. In addition to running a basic science lab, I'm also a practicing physician. So I see patients in sleep medicine clinic on a weekly basis, ranging from things like narcolepsy and hypersomnias and restless leg syndrome to sleep apnea. And I also attend on the neurology wards in the hospital 2 to 4 weeks out of the year. And so that was an interesting experience this summer when I attended, and it was during the pandemic, and it was a very different experience than normal. In terms of NIH awards that I've received, I guess I've gotten awards throughout my sort of career trajectory. When I was a graduate student, I had an F31. And then when I was a postdoctoral fellow with Amita Sigal, I applied and obtained a KO8 award. And then as a PI, I have gotten multiple R01 awards. In terms of my hobbies or passions, I think it's pretty much in the same boat as Anya. We have two small children who are 7 and 4. And so pretty much when I'm not doing work or seeing patients, I'm basically doing stuff for them. For example, this fall, my daughter did soccer for the first time and I was the coach, although I had never played soccer before. So I had to buy like Soccer for Dummies, read it, and then learn all the rules and then coach the kids. So that took a while, but it was a fun experience. And we did have a 7-1 record. So I just wanted to point that out.
Nice.
It wasn't due to the coaching. We just had some excellent players.
Oh, that's great. So let's start big picture. We're talking about the mentor and sponsor statement. What are you trying to achieve with this statement? What is its purpose within the larger context of the grant?
So I think when it came to my mentor and sponsorship statement, it was really important for me to highlight that not only was I doing the work, but in cases where I may not be prepared to do the work, how my mentors and sponsors were going to help me bridge the gap between point A and point B. But not only that, with science, how they were going to support me academically, career-wise, and make me a whole well-rounded scientist overall. And so I really tried to focus on what things did I need to be a scientist and what I felt like I needed, how my mentors were going to be able to supplement that, but then also making sure that my mentors saw any holes in my training, which sounds a little rough, but you know, hindsight's always 20/20. And as Dr. Aronofsky had mentioned, I mean, he has 35 years of experience. And so he's able to see where I'm at as a young developing scientist and get me to where I need to be and where I want to be long term.
So I was just going to say, yeah, from the mentor perspective about the mentor statement, what I try to do is really personalize it to highlight the particular strengths of that person, because every person has special strengths and special skills. And so I try to really tailor it to their particular situation. I'd like to try to tell the story also of the narrative of their training and how they got to where they wanted to be. And I want to also emphasize the commitment and the passion they have for science. And then I agree that it's also important to talk about how we will, as mentors, provide the training and the background to kind of get to where they need to go, to highlight those areas where they can develop, and then how we can provide that with very specific and detailed points. I think that's an important point to make, which is that when you write these things, both as the mentor and the mentee, you want to be specific. You want to provide details. You don't want to just say, oh, so-and-so loves science. You want to show how they love science, which is kind of a common point about good writing, which is that you want to show and not say. But yeah, I think those are some of the basic things I would kind of comment on in terms of the mentor statement.
So if I could add anything, I had actually opportunity to sit on the F31 study section for approximately 7 years. So reviewing grants that are similar to Alexis. And one thing that actually transpired from that is that all of those kids are just incredibly smart. And right now, in order to make someone who you try to promote in any situation, those people have to be presented as somewhat better and or different. Otherwise, it's very difficult to simply differentiate them during the review process. And when it comes to the scientific point, I mean, obviously, project has to be very interesting. And I believe that the grant should be written well. However, it very often helps when you see in a grant that basically it is being done by the student, by the applicant, not necessarily by the mentor. Otherwise, personalized, as you have heard, personalized and one more personalized, generic statements are very boring and not necessarily very convincing.
I think that's a great point to bring up about not having generic statements, but I think that can be hard, right? When so many graduate students are having a very similar experience in terms of expectations set by the graduate program, expectations about rigor and reproducibility. If you all would talk about how you work together, both the trainee and the mentor to ensure that you're on the same page and you're not crafting a generic mentor statement?
Yeah, I think in general, it seems like the most effective mentor statements are ones that really like echo the detailed plan that the applicant themselves has actually come up with. So they should be echoing like the detailed plan, the goals and the steps that need to be taken for, you know, the training of the applicant and the support that's needed to make it happen. Yeah, it's very much not a generic boilerplate.
But I will say that there are things that are common to all graduate students, like you said. So starting off with a generic statement where these are the points that every graduate student needs to have in their experience. We need to hit all of these different things. Now, how your path through them might be very different. So I do think that sort of evaluating strengths and weaknesses and having a plan for building on the strengths, not just saying, hey, you're really good at that, so we're not going to focus on it, because you can always do more with strengths and really develop them. But then also addressing the weaknesses head on and saying, you know, you haven't had as much experience in this, and this is an area of growth. You don't have to have it be a weakness. You can phrase it much nicer than that. And therefore focusing the plan on different areas and supporting some areas more than others. But I think starting off with the generic plan is actually a great place to start and then individualizing from there.
Yeah, I think also as a graduate student, it's important to have these constant conversations with your mentor. And I think that's what made my mentorship statement easily personalizable. That's not a word, but you know, because I mean, even from the jump when I met with Dr. Aronofsky for my rotation, I mean, the very first conversation we had was, what do you want out of your graduate degree? And I think having that idea from the beginning really helped me set the stage for anything in the future and let me have my goals to completing my degree. And so even if you may not know until you're writing your grant of like, oh, what do I want from this? It's still a journey of understanding what you're trying to get out of your training. And if you still haven't had that conversation with your mentor, it's important to start them because you can start setting goals so that in the end, you have reached whatever metric you want for yourself. Because even though we have, you know, the cookie cutter qualifications for any program, you still are able to personalize it for your goals because we aren't all going to end up in the same areas and the same expertise. So just understanding yourself and how your mentors can get you to that endpoint.
I'm actually like nodding so like vigorously over here to Alexis. Like, I completely agree with what she said. I think early on, even before Anya and I heard about the F99, we had these conversations. Like, Anya knew I wanted to apply for like an F grant of some kind very early on. She knew I wanted to pursue a postdoc in the future when I was done with my PhD. So having those conversations, making sure we're on the same page, I think that really helped us create the mentor sponsor statement like very easily and included a lot of the information of where I see myself in like 10 years. So I think one of the biggest things, and I will really echo what Alexis said, is having these conversations really early, making sure you have this open communication with your mentor so that they know like where you see yourself, what you'd like to accomplish in your PhD and after.
And so to that point of thinking about, you know, building on my strengths and figuring out ways to mitigate any potential weaknesses that might be there, one of the things that we talk about a lot in our office is this, it's quote unquote gap analysis approach. So will one of you that use this approach want to explain what it is? And you might have used it without without actually calling it that, but what it is and why it's helpful as a framework.
Sure. I love gap analyses, and I don't know that I use them terribly formally, but I think they're very, very useful. A gap analysis is basically an evaluation of where you are right now, a very frank evaluation of what things look like at the current time, and then a very clear idea of where you want to go. So as Monique said, what are your goals? Where do you see yourself in a few years as you're finishing grad school? After grad school, what do you want to do in the future? And then charting out a path between where you are now and the goals that you see for yourself. And we've already touched on this, but as you go from where you are now, you realize what things need to be done, what things are missing, and you can chart a very specific plan for how to get to the future. And I think that's, I think it needs honesty in both your view for the future and both of your assessment of where you are right now. But I think that's where all the power of it lies, is where you realize, well, I really will need X and I'm just not there yet. And then you can write a very specific plan for what kind of training you need to get to your goal. And I think those kinds of specifics and laid out goals, milestones, are really powerful. And I think that's what really moves reviewers on these panels, is if you see that someone's thought it through very, very carefully, and they have a really good plan with very, very specific things, and that will get them to where they want to be. And I think the other point I want to make about this is that you are not beholden to the plan. In fact, most of the reviewers will not say, oh my goodness, you know, in your report a year out, she's doing something completely different. This is not what we gave her money for. People expect plans to change, but they also want to see that you've thought about things carefully, that you can make good plans. And then if you have to pivot, that's great. So, you know, you don't have to feel like you're really locking yourself into something, but you're just showing that you're very thoughtful about what you want.
And I think the thoughtfulness piece is what helps separate a generic mentor statement and training plan from one that says, I know that this person is going to do everything else these other graduate students are doing in terms of expectations, but this specific trainee needs these things to strengthen their abilities to become a stronger scientist. So that's those are really great points. Anya, thank you.
Yeah, and to your latter point that plans can change, we did have an episode in season one where we talked about, you know, where is the line between a natural expected change and a change that might need a program director's input? It's if you have a substantial change in your research direction, it's like, then you're going to want to check in with your program officer. But that happens too. Sometimes people even change mentors. And so if that's a situation that any of our listeners find themselves in, like, please go back to season one. We did touch on that as well. So thank you for bringing up both those points.
So I think actually I didn't realize that we were doing a gap analysis, but I think the way that Mark and when we have our meetings, it kind of ends up being kind of like a gap analysis. So, you know, we'll have some meetings that are very focused on data and experiments and plans for those things, but then we'll also have periodically these meetings where Mark will say, these are some short-term goals, but then like, what are your midterm goals? And specifically, what do you think you need to do? And where do you actually need to put your effort to get there? So I think that's very, very helpful to actually outline those specific steps. So I didn't know that I was doing gap analysis, but when I looked up what gap analysis was, I was like, yeah, that's actually what we've been doing.
It doesn't matter what you call it. It's that you're taking part in it and you're effectively evaluating yourself, allowing others to evaluate you, right? And say, hey, where do you think I am on this? Or I need to pivot, because you might just need a new set of skills to carry out a different part, a different experiment.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very important, because applying for the K99, you really are, I mean, the whole grant is kind of like a gap analysis in a way, because you're saying, you know, I'm here, I'm a mid or senior postdoc, and you know, I want to be at the stage where I want to be an independent investigator, and what do I need to do to get there?
And Mark, do you have anything else to add in terms of how you see the need for finding these areas for growth? What was your approach? Was it trial and error? Did you figure this out as you went along, or was it something that you yourself experienced as a trainee?
You know, I think my take on this, as far as gap analysis and actually even related to the other questions, is to be an effective mentor, you have to kind of know your mentee and you have to care about them. And I think that those are kind of the first two principles, you know, and so I tried my best, and it gets harder as the lab grows in size, to get to know them as people, to understand their kind of working style, the way they think about things. And because some people respond better to certain, you know, approaches, and some people do better with other kind of strategies. So I think that's really the heart of it, is to get to know the mentee and then care about their success. And then I think everything kind of flows from that. I mean, then it becomes the details of, okay, we need to remember to sit down periodically. I usually call them sort of like what Margaret mentioned, I just sort of call them the sit downs. And I say at the beginning of those meetings that we're not going to talk about your work or your science, but we're going to talk about your career trajectory, your goals. And I think NIH has all these things like IDP plans and things like that, which I've kind of been doing this before all these acronyms and abbreviations came up, but it's all really the same idea, which is just meet, and talk about their goals and plans and then sort of like, and get to know them and really talk about that. I think that that makes for a more effective mentor-mentee relationship and open communication, and then which I think helps. So I guess that's kind of how I would respond to how I sort of look at addressing these kinds of things.
I love that.
One element that, in my opinion, is tremendously important in the training is interacting with the other graduate students. I think that very often we are being treated as someone who they have a little bit of a distance toward, and therefore probably facilitating their ability to interact with people in different places who basically are aligned with their interests, aligned with their project, and allowing them to learn new techniques or new concept is tremendously important. Obviously, all of that has to be under control of the mentor. But I believe that a lot of energy in graduate students, as well as the postdocs, comes from their ability to interact with the right group of colleagues.
I don't think we really have touched on this yet, but one of the things that we recommend including in the mentor statement and sort of in your role in general are milestones. And so once you've established your goals, you need to find ways of measuring whether you're meeting those goals or not. So how did you approach establishing your milestones and formulating them? Did you feel like this was a relatively straightforward and easy task, or was it something that you struggled with?
So I think something that's really good about the graduate school is that we actually have a list of the cookie cutter milestones that we have to meet. And we have to meet with our mentors each year and get this signed and go over it. And having that cookie cutter type thing, I was able to put in what I wanted to do with each year to help me set the goals that I wanted to reach. And so I think that was really helpful when it came to just science in general. Another thing that our graduate school also incorporates is the individual development plan, or the IDP, and being able to do that and also have those milestones a little bit more objectively, I would say, is also nice, because then you just kind of get these reminders like, hey, you said you were going to do this. And so it helps keep you accountable, but then it also helps you realize like, okay, maybe I didn't hit this milestone because of XYZ. So this is how we're going to change the plan, or this is how we're going to, you know, circumnavigate this. And I think that's always important with science, is just being able to be flexible. You can have everything perfectly written out and in some parallel universe, it's going to work, but we're here on this earth and that's not always how it works. And so I think it's nice if you may not, maybe, you know, your graduate school doesn't provide something like that, but I think it's still easy if you look at whatever's required of you and then just set that to a timeline is always important. And so that just keeps everybody accountable in the long term.
So I think what I did in terms of making sure I was on top of my milestones was that I actually printed out my training plan that I sent into the NIH for my F99, and I expanded on that. And I would check that like periodically. And that was my internal like check to make sure that I was meeting all the goals that I wanted to in terms of my professional development, the conferences I'd like to go to, the papers and the reviews I'd like to send out for that year. And I would also bring up any of the things that I was having trouble getting to that goal to Anya, making sure like we were both on the same page. But one of the really nice things that I appreciated too was my committee meetings. I feel like those were really a good place to really put things into perspective, and having like a number of like experts essentially in like your project and Anya there was really helpful to give you an idea of you telling them, okay, these are the goals I'd like to set, and them kind of bringing you back a little bit and making sure you are actually like thinking about everything and all the work that you have to do. So that was really, really helpful for me to remain accountable and also to achieve the goals that I set out for that year.
I think it's great that they allowed you the space to kind of just dream big, and, you know, you can scale it back in terms of what goes on paper, right? Like what's actually submitted, and even, you know, kind of keeping you on track, like, well, maybe that's a little ambitious in that sense, but not telling you, you have to think realistically about this, right? Like it's nice to have a really large scope, you know, you shoot for the moon and then you sort of like say, okay, well, maybe the star over here is like a good place to actually target for takeoff, so to speak.
But I do think it's really important when you do come up with your milestones to think realistically. I think that's something that I see in study section all the time, is you want to strike this really delicate balance between being ambitious and doing lots of things that will provide you with fantastic training. And this is true for the training plan. It's also true for the scientific plan as well. So you want to do cool things and you want to do a lot of things that will help you in the future, but you don't want to do so or propose so much that it's actually taking away from your training and keeping you from publishing your papers and getting your experiments done. So there's a very tight balance. And I think that's something when you're looking at your milestones, you have to sort of get outside from yourself and say, this is great, but which are the most important ones? What's going to be realistic? What's going to be critical to my development rather than just sort of more stuff that would be fun to do?
It's interesting to hear how do you actually like go about achieving and making yourself accountable to all these milestones? Because in the postdoc, it's not as structured as the graduate program where it's very clear you're going to have at least yearly committee meetings. You're going to be accountable to having a lot of opportunities to present your science. So I think with the postdoc, you have to be a lot more intentional and actually outline your specific plan for, you know, what conferences do you want to go to? Where do you actually intend to present your work? When are you going to meet with your mentors? Not only your primary mentor, but also all your co-mentors and your advisors. So I think it's pretty important to actually write that in the grant, like certain ones, I will meet with them every 6 months, or some of them I will meet with them monthly. Yeah. So being very specific about those things and finding the opportunities that may be less intuitive, like attending and participating in the lab meetings of your co-mentor, things like that. I think having that constant feedback on your science from a variety of different places is going to be helpful to make sure that you are progressing in a way that's, you know, efficient.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, especially to your point about postdocs. You're almost like these stepchildren that kind of get forgotten. You don't really have any structure. It's really kind of throwing you into the fire and allowing you to really take charge of how you want to be trained and being able to communicate that with the person you're training under and perhaps other people at the university or in your department that are going to help you achieve those goals so that you can move into independence.
Yeah, it's hard when you don't have a set timeline, but you have to kind of make it for yourself.
Yeah, I'm actually like in the beginning stages of my postdoc, month two. So I know Margaret has more experience, but one piece of advice I got from a postdoc, a senior postdoc, was that very similar to what Margaret said, is you have to be deliberate. You have to seek out these meetings and making sure you're presenting your research and just checking on yourself, essentially, to making sure you're meeting those milestones over time.
So how did you all make sure that the mentor sponsor statement is integrated with and complements the rest of the grant, and that it all felt like one cohesive application, especially since the trainees are expected to write the majority of this? How do you make sure that it all looks like it? This shows that you have really been thoughtful about your research proposal, but also your training plan, and your mentor is also thinking about all of these things.
What I remember is that in terms of the order of writing the grants, the writing the mentor statement was actually came like on the later side of things. So, I mean, we had conversations obviously about the mentor statement before, but it's really after you have written your research plan and after you've written your training plan that the mentor plan actually comes into it later, where it's outlining what's the mentor's role in supporting and assuring that the other stuff happens. If you do after you've written the training plan and have decided on the training plan and the research plan, then the mentor statement kind of just comes and surrounds it.
I have a slightly different take on that. I do agree that there has to be a last pass to make sure it's integrated with the rest of the grant. But I do think that basically giving yourself lots of time, and that's not something Monique and I did because we submitted her grant very quickly, but it really helps to give yourself lots of time to revise. And I think the sponsor statement should be revised at the very last pass as well. And I think that I found with other students that their scientific plan, when we write it, might go in a slightly different direction than we expected if it wasn't quite as worked out ahead of time. And then you have to add elements that will provide the training for that scientific plan. So I think, you know, having everything set and buttoned up and then giving yourself a couple of weeks to go through it and make sure that all the elements align and they're all in place is the way to go. I think few of us write grants that way, but that, I think, would certainly help a lot.
So I remember when I was writing through this grant, I felt like I was constantly repeating myself, but just saying things slightly different to make it tailored to whatever document I was writing. I felt like it was a massive echo chamber, but I think that's also important because I know this was my first time ever writing a grant, and everything in the grad school had said, oh, you know, it's just a 7-page document. You have your specific aims and your 6-page research, you know, training plan. I was like, oh, that's great. But then when you sit down and look at it, it ends up being easily a 70-page document that has to go through so many different people. And so having to keep track of all of that. But I think even when I may not have seen something for a long time, I knew my story was cohesive because even if I picked it back up, I was still able to say, oh, this was this portion, and it still matches what I'm doing here. So even though it may seem very, very redundant, I think if you have that echo chamber in your head, it will continue to shine well with your other documents because then you know that your story is cohesive because you are saying the same thing. And so if there's any discrepancies, then you're able to kind of cross-check all of your documents and know, oh, well, I missed this portion or this part is lacking. And I think that was really helpful in the end, just knowing that I had this redundancy, but also was able to make that section shine really helped with writing and making sure my story was consistent.
Yeah, doing that last check of seeing, you know, it's a very recursive document referring to itself over and over, but just doing that last pass where you check that everything's internally consistent is really important because the reviewers will notice if it isn't.
Oh yeah.
Yes, they will.
One thing that I would probably like to chime in is that obviously, it depends on the stage, but probably every single stage, and very often it applies even to ourselves, is to understand the big picture and actually simplify it. So very often, graduate students are just simply chopped that they know a little bit here, a little bit there. And at the time when it comes to writing a grant, so you need to basically see where it belongs. And so you can actually present it as a piece that is missing and that you do understand where it belongs. So I think that being able to explain and allow the students and postdoc to simply where they are when it comes to the grant within the big picture is very important. Then go to details. I also believe that obviously we all know that there is something like grantsmanship. So we all know that there has to be some sort of elements of novelty, and that novelty to just simply realize may come from the scientific point of view, but also can come from the technical point of view. And actually both are very important. So if you are using this advanced and very novel project, what sort of tools are you using? I mean, you may have a choice to use this or the other technique. And so often using technique, obviously, is the best, but also at the same time, trying to maybe go ahead and propose the techniques that are being challenging and recognized as new and more assuring. So the component of the novelty, I think, is it's very important for, especially for the project for postdocs or graduate students.
Yeah, great point.
All right. Well, thank you all for sharing your wisdom with us and our audience today. Can I ask each of you for one last piece of parting advice for future applicants and for the mentors who will be assisting in some of these applications?
I think it's already been stated, but be honest with yourself and be honest with your mentor. It may seem scary. I know graduate students are still kind of learning their place in the hierarchy, if you will, but the grant is really the time to kind of establish that and establish who you are on a national platform. And so even though you may not fully know that, it's a great time you know, I felt a lot closer to my mentors just because we went through this grant writing process and being able to really map out my future and put it in writing and get that recognition for better or for worse. You know, once you get your scores, it's all up in the air. But I mean, it's a really cool process. It's stressful. But when you get through it, then I feel like you know so much more about yourself and your science. So even though it may be daunting, just do it and learn to use your words and your platforms and your conversations to shape what you want out of your, not only grant, but like what you want out of your degree.
I'll follow up on that. I would say one piece of advice would be to communicate with your mentor, communicate early, make sure that you both are on the same page. And I would say, yeah, that's like the biggest thing I would say that really helped us write the F99K00. And also a really important thing is to set milestones and realistic goals for yourself that you know you can accomplish during this period. And one thing that Anya and some other mentors mentioned is that the research is a big portion of the grant, but creating a balanced like approach to your grant, including professional development, writing papers and so on, is also an important aspect of your training and your career. And yeah, that's all I have.
I can go. I guess I have two pieces of advice. One, just from serving on these study sections for the last few years, I will say that the standards keep changing. I think that applicants, both sponsors and mentees, are getting more and more sophisticated about the kinds of grants they put in. So if you're going to look at successful examples and you're looking at something from 5 years ago, that might no longer be a successful grant. So look at things that are more recent. And for applicants, it is brutal. There are so many talented, talented applicants like you. And if that's great news for science. It's fantastic. But it is really tough to get funded. And don't give up. I have had some fantastic students in my own lab who had to put in their grants two or three times before they were successful. And they are now, you know, very successful scientists in their own right. So don't get too disappointed when you don't get funded. Just try again.
I'll add, I mean, you guys gave great advice already, but I'd also add that, you know, starting early and getting comfortable with having a lot of revisions and not being too wedded to all the specific components in your grant is maybe one lesson that I learned throughout this process. So, you know, as you're writing the grant, you might love like a specific aim, but actually if you just show your grant to a lot of different people, you'll get a lot of great comments. And also try to give your grant to other people to read, people who are not necessarily in your direct field, maybe other people who are, say, like also neuroscientists, but aren't specifically working in your model system or working on your specific concept. I think that's very helpful. I definitely use we have an internal, I guess, internal review panel at Hopkins that my grant went through. And that was very helpful because you definitely get comments from people who are not so intimately familiar with your specific topic. That reflects more the type of people who are going to review your grant, not just you and your advisor and your little echo chamber.
I think it's a really great idea to start from the specific aim page. And there were even some studies done by NIH when they have distributed grants versus the specific aims to some group of specialists. And the default was actually identical, that the same grants almost being supported based on the specific aims versus the whole grant. So by basically reviewing grants for past 20 years, I can tell you that the climate you will produce by reading specific aim page is going to last for all the remaining pages. So if the impression of the grant from the very beginning is positive and you learn a lot, it is so much easier to be supportive for the remaining pages. So I think that that also helps to clarify your ideas and to prioritize your experiments. And then if you do have the specific aim idea and select the experiments and provide the background for it,
it's so much easier to keep up with a remaining portion of the grant and write it in a more and a faster and more concise and clear way. And there is less distraction because you already have some template of what you want to achieve. So the remaining 7 pages or 6 pages you have to write are much simpler for you.
Certainly, if you have a good framework and a good first impression, it certainly makes things a lot easier.
I was just going to address, I guess, what is our advice for mentees who are having challenges talking about, you know, some of these issues or training plans or things with their mentor? So at Hopkins, I also serve on the Postdoctoral Fellow Advisory Board, where we deal with the training and the welfare of all postdocs across the School of Medicine. And so this issue comes up sometimes when, for example, trainees or mentees that have decided that they want to pursue a diverse career path and not necessarily an academic scientific path. And sometimes, unfortunately, the mentors are not supportive. And so my advice in those situations is basically that trainees should not be afraid to have direct and open communications with their mentor at early stages, even when you're rotating, really. If, for example, if there's a graduate student who is not sure that they want to do academics and is interested in different paths, that you talk to your mentor and just be direct about it. Or you could directly ask the mentor, how will you support me if we do write a K grant or something like that together? And then if it turns out that you guys, the mentee and mentor, have sort of different goals and different paths, then maybe it's not the best fit, you know, and that's better, always better to figure out early than later.
Lauren, do you have any advice for our audience?
I guess I'll just reiterate something we talked about earlier, which is that this plan that you put in your application doesn't have to include every single thing that you're doing. You can do more than what you put in there. So you really want to think about like presenting the reviewers with a very nice, well thought out, easy to read, easy to understand, justified story. And it's okay if you're planning on doing other things that you don't include in there because they reviewers might think that they were a distraction or overambitious. So just definitely take Margaret's advice and give it to lots of people to read and take their feedback seriously and make sure that your grant is just wrapped up with a nice little bow. And Margaret, what about you?
Yeah, I'd like to also amplify what has been said previously about the relationship between mentor and mentee. It's an opportunity to really get a chance to show your interest, but also where you think you need to improve and where your mentor thinks you need to improve. I think that's not something we do naturally. You just want to hit the ground running. And as a PhD student, I think many of us can relate. We're so ambitious and we want to do it on our own and show how great we are. And thinking about a weakness as something that has to be a negative, but really it's just an opportunity to grow and mature as a scientist. And that shouldn't happen in isolation, right? This should be something that you are constantly working on with your mentor. And I think putting together the application and particularly the mentor statement gives you an opportunity to be very frank about what the expectations are, what the desire is to move forward. And it should be something that if you aren't able to have that sort of conversation, that it may be a sign to find another training opportunity. And sometimes that doesn't, it doesn't sound like a great thing, but I think to Mark's point earlier, it may be something that has to happen in order for you to be able to have the best training experience possible. And I think that's one of the great things about many of these training opportunities is that you're sort of forced to now think about these things that maybe you can easily just sweep under the rug because you're just going through the motions, going through your program as normal. And this really brings to light your own interests and how those align with that of the mentor. So,
good point. So that's all we have time for today on Building Up the Nerve. So thank you to our guests this week for sharing their expertise. And thank you to NINDS Program Director, Dr. Bob Riddle, for composing our theme song and music. We'll see you next time when we tackle letters of recommendation and letters of support.
And you can find past episodes of this podcast and many more grant application resources on the web at NINDS.com. health.nih.gov. You can follow us on Twitter at NINDS Diversity and at NINDS Funding. Email us your questions at nindsnervepod@nih.gov, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We'll see you next time.